Good morning. My name is Grace, and we'll be reading from 1 Corinthians 13 today. And yet I will show you the most excellent way. If I speak in the tongues of men and or of angels, but do not have love, I'm only a resounding gong or a clanging cymbal. If I have the gift of prophecy and can fathom all mysteries and all knowledge, and if I have a faith that can move mountains but do not have love, I am nothing. If I give all I possess to the poor and give over my body to hardship that I may boast, but do not have love, I gain nothing. Love is patient. Love is kind. It does not envy. It does not boast. It is not proud. It does not dishonor others. It is not self-seeking. It is not easily angered. It keeps no record of wrongs. Love does not delight in evil, but rejoices with the truth. It always protects, always trusts, always hopes, always perseveres. Love never fails. But where there are prophecies, they will cease. Where there are tongues, they will be stilled. Where there is knowledge, it will pass away. For we know in part, and we prophesy in part. But when completeness comes, what is in part disappears. When I was a child, I talked like a child. I thought like a child. I reasoned like a child. When I became a man, I put the ways of childhood behind me. For now we see only a reflection as in a mirror. Then we shall see face to face. Now I know in part, then I shall know fully, even as I am fully known. And now these three remain, faith, hope, and love. But the greatest of these is love.
This might be a little bit ambitious, but I'm hoping by the end of this talk, you'd be more loving. Maybe a little bit ambitious, because I know you already are loving. We're all committed to love, but this passage sets a really high bar, not a low bar. It's not just about committing to love, but it's about elevating love right up there as a key priority. And if you were to think back over the last week at a time you weren't as loving as you could have been, it's not because you're not committed to love. Like, you want to love. It's just that some other pressure of life or some other priority came in over the top and made you relegate love. Let me express this by way of an illustration. I was listening to a radio station one day, and there was this segment that makes you choose between love or money. They were giving it $5,000 away. They brought in a lady onto the show called Ashley, and they handpicked her because she needed money. She'd come from New Zealand. Her husband had had a workplace accident, and they were struggling for income. And then her dad had died, and they'd put their flights to New Zealand on credit. And then when they got back to Australia, they were struggling for enough money to, you know, pay for the kids' food. And they wanted to go back to New Zealand to be with their grieving mum. They really needed money. So the radio show goes outside and they grab this other lady called Kate. She's just walking the dog. They bring her in. They say, we're going to get you in to play give or take. You're going to give the $5,000 or you're going to take it for yourself. And what they didn't realize is that this lady walking the dog also was working weekends and night shifts to try and get enough money because she only had $8 in her bank account. She couldn't afford to provide braces for her kids. She was delaying giving her son braces, and their electricity bill was at this point unpaid. So difficult financial situation as well. What are you going to choose, love or money? This just highlights the challenge of exercising love in everyday life. There's so many competing priorities. What are you going to choose? Well, what's beautiful about that story is that Kate chose to give the $5,000 to Ashley, and Ashley walked away with the $5,000. But it just highlights that there's all these competing things. Is it love or is it security? Is it my family or is it this other person who really needs it? How do I exercise love in life? And I think the difference between us isn't whether we're committed to love, because we're all committed to love. I think what makes someone stand out as a super loving person in our eyes is because they'll put love above security. They put love above their, you know, finances. They'll put love above their health. They'll put love above, you know, whether they're tired, they'll just keep pushing through. Whereas maybe someone who has less of a reputation for love is someone who would put money above love and success above love and put their, you know, their belly before love, their preferences, that kind of thing. So one of the blind spots in the church, and one of the reasons why some people would look at church members and say they're not as loving as someone who I know outside of church, is because we've got these blind spots, we've got these competing priorities, and we don't always realize when we've relegated love. Because even if God is love, and even if Jesus says that a summary of the Christian life is to love God and to love your neighbor, sometimes we don't realize that we're elevating other priorities above love, and in doing so becoming unloving. The challenge of this passage is to elevate love, to put it at the high place. And there's a blind spot going in, so let's think about the Corinthians and where we've come so far. The Corinthians have a blind spot. They're putting other things above love. We've already heard in the story so far that when it came to leadership, they put wisdom and knowledge above love. They'd been taught about love, but when it came to intimacy and relationships, they put sex ahead of love. They'd been taught about love, but when it came to the religious meals, they put their appetite above love, and they divided over things. So now here we're in 1 Corinthians 12 to 14, and this is a section about spirituality and what it means to be truly spiritual. And in the middle of these three chapters, the author Paul takes out a whole chapter to talk about love and to elevate love to the higher place. So you see it there in the first and the last sentence of our reading. It says, "Yet I will show you the most excellent way." And at the end, "Now these three remain, faith, hope, and love. But the greatest of these is love." Love is elevated to become the most excellent, the most grand, the highest thing. But the Corinthians had elevated other spiritual things above love. And so if you look at the first three verses, they'd elevated tongues above love. In verse 2, they'd elevated prophecy, knowledge, and faith above love. And in verse 3, they'd elevated giving above love. And I just want to park something for a minute. Prophecy and tongues, I'm not going to explain them today. I'm just going to park that. We've done that a bit the last few weeks, haven't we? But I'm deliberately parking it because it takes a fair bit of time to explain. And our senior minister, Nigel, has dedicated the next couple of weeks to looking at tongues and prophecy. So come back for that. But for now, all we need to know is that tongues and prophecies were at the top of the list of things that the, you know, Corinthians felt that they needed to be spiritual. It's at the top of the list of the things that they felt that they needed to feel good about their Christian life. And that's their blind spot. They've elevated spiritual gifts above love, and therefore they've relegated love to a lower place. So Paul makes this point really clearly. Just let me read the three verses and let it, you know, speak to you. "If I speak in the tongues of men or of angels, but do not have love, I'm only a resounding gong or a clanging cymbal. If I have the gift of prophecy and can fathom all mysteries and all knowledge, and if I have faith that can move mountains, but do not have love, I am nothing. If I give all I possess to the poor and give over my body to hardship that I may boast, but do not have love, I gain nothing." You can feel the rhythm and the repetition. If I have a gift. Without love, I am a noisy nothing. The problem's not the gift. The problem is when you elevate the gift above love. If you lower love in that way, if you do not have love, you are a noisy nothing. Christians are meant to be known for their love, but unfortunately, Christians can take something as good as a spiritual gift and turn it into a noisy nothing. And I want to tell you a story just to try and help illustrate this. I went to the dentist this week. When I was hanging out at the dentist, the dental hygienist was such a nice person. She was asking about my job. And when I told her I work in the church and that I work in the particular part of the church where I'm trying to help people understand Christianity who might be looking into it, I just made this comment like, But religion's really tricky for people to talk about. I wish people felt more comfortable talking about it. And she resonated with that. And I asked her, I said, in your family growing up, was everyone aligned or on the same page about religion? And she said, yeah, we were actually. We grew up Catholic, going to church. And then she explained that she had a really bad experience at university. She started to open up that an atheist and another Christian friend of hers went along to a church. And at the church, from the minute she walked in, she said it was just something was off. And the preacher was just angry and yelling. And he was telling everyone all these different categories of people that are going to hell. And then he explained, if you cannot speak in tongues, then you are going to hell. She didn't realize how much she needed to talk about that experience. She said, oh, I haven't had anyone to talk to about that. And it happened 3 years ago. And I've been unsettled about God since. And what are the chances of having a good chat while you've got tubes hanging out your mouth? But she was so nice that she was like taking the tubes out and listening. But what are the chances that I was preaching 1 Corinthians 13 this week? So I'd memorized the first verse and I explained it to her. And it's really clear, if I speak in the tongues of men or of angels, but do not have love, I'm only a resounding gong or a clanging cymbal. And you just feel relief. She said, that's really in the Bible. She wrote it down, and she wrote down the link to YouTube. So if she's watching today, thanks for letting me share your story. Now, isn't it sad that as a church, that churches and that Christians can turn something as good as spiritual gifts into a noisy nothing, and then to invite people into church and make them feel terrible, and to really leave people with that bitter taste in their mouth? Let's do better as a church. Let's elevate love. But what is love? You want to live with love. What is love? How would you describe it? This is the middle part of the chapter. If we wanted to elevate love to its rightful place, we need to understand what it is. So the next paragraph from verse 4 to 7 is a description of love. It's famous. A lot of you have heard this at a wedding. It's really a beautiful poem. It has a lot to say about love. And I went and checked on the internet. It's a quote at Goodreads with 11,392 likes. It's popular. People like it. It sounds, there's a lot in there. So it's popular and good advice for marriage, but it wasn't obviously originally written for the marriage context. What is the context going on here? Well, what's interesting is that the poem starts by giving us two things that love is. Can I get the next slide? Two things that love is, followed by eight things that love is not, which is really interesting because then it's taking on the flavor of a corrective. Love is not, love is not, love is not. And so in this way, it's not a definition of love. It is a description of sorts, but it's even a corrective type of description written to the Corinthian church, who are being an unloving church community. Still great advice for a wedding and for a marriage. And as we'll see when we go through it, everything applies to a marriage. But specifically, this was written for the church to be more loving. And for the Corinthians, the first and the last thing that they needed to hear in this paragraph is that love starts with patience and ends with perseverance. Isn't it interesting? The first thing that gets mentioned is patience, because love requires you to be able to put up with a fair bit of mess. Love requires you to have a fair bit of patience for people's junk, for all of the irritations, for all of the things that make it harder. Love isn't about finding the perfect person who just never irritates, but it's about bringing together people who are quick to listen and slow to anger and jump in and correct. It's actually about patience that calms and de-escalates tension, because it's willing to sit in a bit of discomfort with patience and listen and understand before jumping in. Love is patient. Love is persevering. I want to ask you, how are you going at patience and persevering? Because a loving church is the kind of church where people in it are patient and are persevering, just as we ought to be in our households and in our friendships. But I reckon a church done like this would stand out as pretty countercultural in a community sense. Like, think of every reality TV show you've ever watched, and I think a church wouldn't make a very good reality TV show, because a reality TV show, you get all these people in that are ready to have a fight, you put them at the dinner table, you throw a grenade in the middle of the room, and everyone watches because they love it blowing up as there's envy and bitterness and competitiveness and self-seeking. You suck all that out, makes for a great community, just not a very good TV show. That's what the church is meant to be. Why do we like those TV shows so much? Sometimes they make us feel a little bit better about our own life. They make us feel like, hey, I'm not as bad as that. But my question for you is, what are your blind spots? What tests people's patience around you? There's a bunch of blind spots listed in the passage, and I want to just throw up on the screen here. It's got everything from envy and pride to anger and record keeping. But I don't want to go through all these words because I don't want you to walk away with the ability to describe love. I want you to walk away more loving. And you could all list all of these things and talk about love, but I just want you to pick for today, what's one thing on that list that you could work on? What's one thing on that list that you could see as a bit of a blind spot in your life, that if you were to commit to progressing today, which one would it be? I'm going to leave that list up there for a little bit. Just talk about what it's like to live in the life of the brain of a minister. I just want to share my weakness from this list. I could go through each one and show you a story from each one about the weaknesses in my life. But if I had to just pick one, I'll just go with the word self-seeking. And I was driving to the city earlier this week because I got invited to go on a podcast, and you get a bit nervous about that kind of stuff. So I'm driving along, and on one side, my voice is saying, what are you going to say? You got nothing to say. Like, you're going to say something silly and make a fool of yourself. And then on the other side, the voice is saying, no, you've got experience. You've got things you could say. You might say something wise. You might get more respect. I'm sorry to say, the problem with both of those voices, they're all about me. And this is me being open with you. We're all wrestling with these kinds of things. As I drove out there, I'm thankful to God that I begin to pray. And the Holy Spirit does minister to me and help me as the voices start to dissipate and I start thinking, well, what can I say that will help the person at the other end? What can I say that's going to encourage the people that I meet today, that are going to be part of this podcast and all that? It's just a shift of mindset, but I need God to help me with that, because in myself, I struggle with self-seeking. I want to invite you to have a chat about that after the service, and I'll pray that you walk away from this service more loving as a result. What happens if we don't change? What happens if we stay self-seeking and all these other things? Well, apart from undermining the unity of the church and making noise in the eyes of God, if we don't change, one of the consequences is that there might be a visitor here today who never comes back. I was telling my wife Michelle the story of the dental hygienist who had a bad experience of church, and I thought she expressed her reaction in a really helpful way. She said, it's like my worst nightmare that you finally bring someone to church because you want them to know the love of God. And the week that they come to church, the love of God gets dumbed down and lost in translation. It's like just good language for it, isn't it? And that's exactly what we don't want. We don't want to be a church where the love of God gets dumbed down and lost in translation. If you're a visitor here today, then I hope you hear loud and clearly that God is loving. And the measure of love isn't fundamentally and ultimately the church. The church is trying to reflect the love of God and learn to grow into the love of God. We're seeking to elevate love as God calls us to better. But I hope you'll walk away today with a sense of God's love for you. And that's actually where I want to finish my last kind of part of this talk today. I want to speak to the love of God, because love comes from God, and God's love never fails. That's where the paragraph from verse 8 takes us. Love never fails. How is it true that love never fails when my love fails and your love fails? It's because God's in charge and his love never fails. Love wins in the end. When it says love never fails, it means love never ends. It never collapses or crumbles like an ancient ruin. It outlasts all other things, including tongues and prophecy, because in the end, there is eternal love. If only the Corinthians could realize it. They were so focused on the spiritual outworking that they had lost touch with the heart of their faith, which was the love of God. The love of God is the crescendo of Christianity. It's like the high point. And if you truly understand it, you'll see it's the heart and the high point of the Christian faith that God's love never fails. It was nice that Joe, our song leader today, read this passage for us. I'm going to come back to it from 1 John 4:8. God is love. By the way, this is another passage that often gets read at weddings, about the love of God at a Christian wedding. God is love. This is how God showed his love among us. He sent his one and only Son into the world that we might live through him. This is love. Not that we loved God, but that he loved us and sent his Son as an atoning sacrifice for our sins. There's a lot in there, and I'm not going to unpack the whole thing because it's not our passage for today, but I just want to highlight two things. Firstly, God is love, and secondly, God has shown his love. God is love. You can't flip it and say love is God. What does it mean, God is love? It means before anything existed, God existed in a state of love. And after everything winds up, God will continue to exist in an eternal state of love. God is love. And God has shown his love. This is how he showed his love among us, through the person Jesus. He sent his Son. Jesus was patient. Jesus was kind. Jesus didn't envy. Jesus didn't boast. Jesus was the great example of love, and his love was perfected as we see it when he gave his life to die on the cross. He gave up his physical needs and he suffered at that moment. And if we think of our story at the beginning with Kate and Ashley on the radio, what are you going to choose, money, or you know, you're going to take the money or you're going to give it? And she chose love over security. Well, think of Jesus as the more excellent example, who gave up his physiological needs to the point of dying on a cross. This is where we see the love of God. This is how we know God loves us, because Jesus died for us. And if you're here today once again as a guest and you're still thinking about Christianity, you're trying to understand what does it mean that God loves me, then I just want to keep coming back to the fact that the moment to see his love is when Jesus dies on the cross. And if you don't yet understand all the details of that, then I thoroughly want to encourage you to come to Easter. Because Easter is about the death of Jesus, and it's the time where we see the love of God on display, and we'll have more time to unpack it then. Easter is a high point in the Christian faith for the way it shows the love of God. But what's really cool for the Christian is that high point of Easter just anticipates another high point that's to come. And I want to finish on this. It's verse 12, actually. This is going to help us to see that the real crescendo of the love of God is to come in the future, where we see in verse 12, "For now we see only a reflection as in a mirror, then we shall see face to face. Now I know in part, then I shall know fully, even as I am fully known." Talks there about a mirror, but do you know what a mirror used to look like? Check out this picture of a mirror. A mirror these days, glass, high resolution detail, but you know, it was pretty faded, polished metal back in the day. You didn't get a very good sense of what you were looking at. And what this is saying is, yeah, right now you do need prophecy. You need people with insight and the ability to see so that they can help you capture glimpse and understand something of God. But one day you're not going to need that anymore, because when you meet God face to face, you will know Him perfectly and you will know His love in a way that you've never known. I just love the way that it says it, that I shall know fully, even as I am fully known. That we will know just as God knows us. That is the high point of the future. So God is love. We've seen His love. Let's elevate love. Let's walk out of here more loving. Because these three remain, faith, hope, and love, but the greatest of these is love.